The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
And welcome back to Scarred for Life, the podcast where we open up old wounds by looking back at the films that scared us as kids. I'm Terry.
And I'm Mary Beth.
In each episode, our special guest or guests bring with them a movie that traumatized them as a child.
Y'all, I'm so hyped. I just saw this movie and I'm so excited to be chatting with our guests today. Our guests are Arkasha Stevenson and Tim Smith. They have collaborated previously together on shows like Channel Zero and Brand New Cherry Flavor, but their latest collaboration is on The First Omen, which opens in theaters on April 5th with Arkasha directing and helping write, with Tim also helping write. Welcome to the show!
Hello, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yay! Very excited to be chatting with you today about all of the things, but I'm not sure which I'm more excited about, your pick or the movie that y'all just made, so...
Yeah. I'll go either way. So,
So for our listeners that might not be familiar, can you fill them in on the plot of the First Omen and how you guys maybe came about to be attached to this project?
Yeah, for sure. And you should. I'm highly caffeinated, so please just jump in. But so the First Omen is a prequel to the original 1976 Omen, and the story is about this young novitiate who travels to Rome from America with the intention of taking her vows to become a nun. And while she's there, she's volunteering at an orphanage where she meets this young girl and starts to discover that there's this dark conspiracy that is starting to swallow both of them whole. And we were super lucky. A friend of ours sent us the script. Her name's Gracie. She's also a producer at Phantom Four. And we were really surprised by it because I think, you know, we both love the Omen franchise. Like, just, I think even when we were kids, we both were obsessed with it. So, but it's very, you know, it's pretty male driven, you know? Yeah. So I was really shocked when I saw that the lead for this was going to be a novitiate. So that's kind of what hooked me.
Yeah, and I think because we were such fans of The Omen, I think we met the script with extreme skepticism. Mm-hmm. To us, like dealing with such a sacred property like that, you don't want to mess with it unless you have something to say and you feel like you can kind of inject your voice as a filmmaker into it, because we're so, so protective of horror films like that. So we knew... we wanted to treat it seriously if we were going to take it on.
Yeah, I have like distinct childhood memories of sitting on the couch watching The Omen and eating like pudding with my hands, you know. So I was 16. And no.
You guys, this was 2 years ago.
Yeah,
exactly. Talk about scar for life. That's a strong visual.
Just walking in your pajamas, shoveling pudding in your face because you're so scared and you're just like, what?
So
I will say on IMDb there's a lot of credits for like who wrote what, and so I would love to know like where y'all came in terms of writing and screenplay for this film as well, if you don't mind going into that.
Yeah, I mean, the film I think has a long history preceding us, and we essentially inherited a script, and we inherited it, and you know, we effectively got to take it over and got to kind of do a page one rewrite and just pitched our take on it and said, we kind of want everything to be through our main character, Margaret's subjectivity. And we want to kind of ground it in this idea of female body horror. And we want to kind of steer it in a different direction and kind of pitch that take on it. And they kind of let us take the reins on the script from there.
Yeah.
So that brings me so much joy because I don't want to spoil anything. And I'm going to try real hard to like talk around it. But this movie is really about rape in a way that I was not expecting and was really, really exciting for me, which I know sounds weird. But as a survivor myself, as someone who is really interested in rape revenge, seeing a movie that finally is confronting the Catholic Church and it's not just like superhero propaganda is like really surprising in the best way possible. And I love that we get a new version of religious horror on the big screen that isn't like, Jesus will save us all, because we don't need any more of that. And I love how y'all took this into something very dark in a very different way, but in a way that we need to see. And so you talked about this a little bit, talking about wanting to make it more from, you know, from Margaret's point of view, but I wanted to hear more about kind of deciding to go that route with the script and really committing to it, because holy shit, I'm like super into it.
Thank you so much for saying that, because that was a really, that was a pretty big swing to want to talk about that with Disney.
And I was wondering.
It's an intense direction to go in, but I think, you know, we were talking about this when we first read the script, and I said to Tim, what's the scariest moment for you? And he said,
yeah, without spoiling anything, I think the exact moment you're thinking of. And, you know, I think all the other horror beats up until then in the script were really of an entirely different tone and sensibility. It was much more religiously themed horror and something really grounded that was kind of glossed over, which you're touching on, really got to me. And I was thinking, if we can kind of take that and extrapolate all the horror to kind of center on this character's subjectivity and this feeling of kind of her violation and sense of self being violated, and if that's kind of the core of the horror that we're exploring. So that was really important to us. And we kind of approached the studio and said, kind of take it or leave it. This is the horror film we're interested in. And that kind of completely recontextualized the movie that we were making.
Because doing a film, a horror film from the female perspective, that's we kind of live our lives in a horror film, because that is a constant threat to us. And I think watching, I loved horror as a kid, you know, but I always felt very alienated by the way the female body was presented and the female condition. And it always felt a little like slasher films always felt a little like a bit like Picarism to me. I don't know if that sounds super pretentious, but it did feel like hypersexualized, hyper fetishized. And so something that we talked a lot about was like presenting female anatomy in a very unsexualized way and purely through personal fear. And it was, I mean, hell, the studio was behind us on it, you know, which is a really big deal for us.
That's so awesome.
That makes me happy, because sometimes it's like, why don't we see these things in horror? But it's exciting to see a studio supporting that. That gives me hope for the future and what subjects. And they're promoting it so heavily too, which is awesome to see that there is pushing behind a story like this, which just makes my heart very happy, especially because I know how hard it is with, like, as a woman directing, telling a very specifically female driven matriarchal in like a devilish matriarchy kind of way. And I really, that just makes me feel good.
Yeah.
So anyway.
No, it was a hugely pleasant experience, because I mean, there weren't, you know, in this industry, there aren't going to be a lot of women on projects like these, you know? And so being able to say like, hey guys, my experience is more like this, and they say, go for it, you know, a lot of trust was in this process, which I did not expect that, and was just, you know,
hell yeah.
It was a real gift. It was cool.
I have to ask, because while I have not seen the movie yet, I love Nell Tigerfree in Servant, which is how I found her and was like, I was obsessed with that show. Wrote about it every single episode. I did a recap on, like, just obsessed with it. So to see her in this as the lead, from what I'm gathering, awesome. What was it like working with her?
It was unbelievable. I mean, the funny thing too is in development, you know, we were kind of like shot out of a cannon and sent to Rome immediately. And they were kind of like, went from, we don't know if you're going to make this movie, you're probably not, to like, you're not only making it, but you're going to Rome right now.
Thanks.
Yeah. And one of the curses of like being old farts at birth, like we are, is we watch a bunch of old films. Like, we don't watch a lot of modern day releases. So when they were like, what woman do you want to cast in this film? We were like, we don't watch anything, so we don't know.
Isabella Angiani.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
you say that name, and I'm going to ask you something about that in a second.
Yeah, the craziest thing is, on the flight to Rome, I watched Servant. And it's like, when I got on the plane, I didn't know who Margaret was. And when I landed, I was telling Kasha, it's Nell. Nell's got to be Margaret. And she was unbelievable. I mean, you know, having seen the film, it's an incredible burden that's placed on her. The film really rests on her shoulders. Yeah. She's every day she was working. So, you know, obviously it requires a tremendous amount of talent, but there's also stamina, you know, and mm-hmm. she has to kind of be a leader with the rest of the cast and crew. She's really setting the tone. So she was so game and willing to get, you know, dirty and kind of go to all different types of places and really had no ego, which was such a gift for us.
Yeah. And she was more like, she really became such a important, like an enormous collaborator on this where it would, you know, it's very tough with a short schedule and you're running around and we got to do this, but she was always like throwing out ideas and just fully trusting in the vision right off the bat, which is really important because we were thrown into it really fast all together, you know, but she's a dragon. She's fearless.
She's feral in this movie too. I love seeing her go from, again, like that very put together novitiate to being absolutely feral in a scene that no spoilers. Is it inspired by Possession? Because you said Isabelle and Donnie, and I was like, oh yeah, okay. I just had to know. Possession was a favorite of yours.
It's a absolute shameless homage.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with that. I was like, yeah. I'm in my press screening, like cheering. I'm the only woman, just like, yes, 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 yes.
Yeah. So, I love you. Thank you.
We were at
sorry, I'm like being a dork right now. I apologize.
No, you are in good company. Thank you.
We were at a point in writing the script where you're just like susceptible to everything. And we saw a print of Possession and like almost immediately went home that night. And we were like, this is the perfect inspiration for what we want to do.
It's just so funny. It's like, I started sobbing when I first saw that scene, like in public sobbing, because nothing has visually expressed more what I cannot articulate about. I don't know if this is like going to freak people out, but kind of what I feel like on a daily basis, you know?
No, but for real.
Yeah. It was the most cathartic thing to watch on screen, to the point where I was donkey heaving, you know, just sobs. Wow. And thinking about it, it was like, it feels like something that feels so personal and true that you shouldn't be allowed to see it in public.
Yeah, right.
It feels so secret and personal. And so for that to be doing a film that wants to talk about the female body through body horror perspective, I think that that's the queen of all scenes, right? And so it felt very right to talk to Nell and say, like, how do you feel about this? And Nell was like, oh yeah, I don't even need to prep, I'm ready. Mm-hmm. And I was like, man, this was the top of the second week we worked together.
Dang.
And 4 a.m., we just smashed a car, smashed it right in. Mm-hmm. And then it's like Nell's time to take the street over. And, you know, the crew was just like, I don't know if the crew really knew what kind of movie we were making just yet. And and we were all just kind of, you know, you feel good. Do you want music? She's like, nah, I'm just going to do it. I'm like, okay. And she only did 2 takes. Yeah.
To transition, this feels like a movie made by horror fans. Like, you guys have, especially, I made notes about like kind of the very 70s-esque zooms in on things. And like, there is very much like, there's a horror loving aesthetic in this movie. So it sounds like the two of you have been horror fans forever, or at least for a very long time. Can you tell us about a little bit about your horror histories and like how long you've been horror fans?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it is a lifelong love of horror. I mean, I always say like my earliest memory is walking around in pinhead masks and Freddy Krueger hands. You know, I dressed up as Dracula in preschool and my parents had like Killer Clowns from Outer Space, you know, is one of that, you know, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I got shown so many inappropriate films at such a young age.
Were your parents big horror fans?
Huge. I mean, my dad.
Okay, cool.
Huge horror fan. I mean, it was all, you know, Fright Night and straight like Lawnmower Man, In the Mouth of Madness. You know, he's a huge Carpenter fan. House, Return of the Living Dead 3, Demon Knight. You know, like all kinds of
stuff. Oh, hell yeah. Like goopy, gross.
That's quite an education in horror.
It is. Yeah. And it's funny too, because I kind of like branched off into different ideas of what horror was, but he very much at an early age kind of sat me down and was like, I'm going to show you a lot of messed up horror films because I love it. And
I'm going to make you my protege.
My upbringing, yeah.
And now look at you. Now you're making a prequel to The Omen, which is so cool. That's got to be a proud moment.
Yeah, it is. Very, very much. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You got a proud dad.
Yeah.
That's nice. Yeah.
What about you, Akasha?
Well, truth be told, I think that I'm being really honest about the movie that scarred me for life, it was Braveheart, because I was brought to the movie theaters when I was 4. And my mom claimed she thought it was a Care Bear movie, but come on, girl. I think she's just joking.
You saw him in The Kill. You know who you were doing. You couldn't resist.
She just wanted some Mel Gibson. but that's okay. but yeah, I started off pretty young because, I used to watch A&E a lot. And on Valentine's Day, they would have the double feature. Do you guys remember this?
I do.
The Shining Exorcist double feature. And I became obsessed. And like the idea of Valentine's Day and the Exorcist are forever melded in my head now.
Oh,
yeah. Right. And my mom was like, well, if you like these movies, you should see X, Y, and Z. And so Rosemary's Baby and, The Omen.
So both had pretty encouraging parents when it came to genre. It wasn't like sneaking it. It was very much an encouraged habit. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, but also like on a totally dark note, I'm sure that just our parents are such realists that horror movies aren't really that scary for them. You know, it's really...
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I think realism, that's scary for them. So they're like, yeah, take it all in.
Yeah.
Go for it.
So it sounds like you guys have been watching horror movies since you were like, what, 4 or so? Were you a scared kid watching horror movies, or were you both able to like deal with the horror? Did anything bother you when you were a kid?
Yeah. I mean, it's
how long is this podcast?
Yeah, exactly. It's funny because like I was saying, I watched a lot of, creature feature slasher films kind of dealing with the supernatural or otherworldly. And there's watching The Omen, films like that, and The Exorcist and The Vanishing and, eventually Michael Haneke stuff, dealing with stuff that dealt with a more grounded horror that kind of took the otherworldly or supernatural and made it feel recognizable and real. That's what started to freak me out, is when I thought like, okay, this could actually happen. This is rooted in something that feels real. Those are the kind of films that started to get under my skin.
When you can't really differentiate between real life and what's in the movie. My mom showed me a lot of Stranger Danger videos when I was a kid. Sorry, this is going to become a therapy session very quickly. I hope that's okay.
Oh no, it becomes a therapy session every episode, and I love it. Yeah. It's incredible.
You're watching all of these when you're a kid. You just like get. I mean, I'm so glad that she showed me these videos because I think it made me a really vigilant kid. But it also terrified me, thinking that humans would want to, harm me. Yeah. So I actually had a really hard time sleeping a lot at night. So what I would do is I would just watch TV, and always the Twilight Zone was on. Ah. And so like Rod Serling and the Twilight Zone became kind of like my comfort blanket.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's just been, it's like almost like trained to love horror.
Yeah.
Do you still get scared now when you watch things, or is it harder to scare you as adults?
I think it's movie. Have you ever seen, do you know like Bruno Dumont and his like experimental horror? There's this movie, 29 Palms.
Oh, I've seen, you are the only other person I know that's seen 29 Palms except for me.
Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry that you saw it. It's like, it took me 4 months to bounce back from that movie. When did you see it?
So during grad school, because I wrote about rape revenge movies for grad school. And so I was like, well, okay, this seems like an interesting one to watch. And I was like, Jesus Christ, this is bleak.
Man, it is dark stuff. Like that is like horror, not fun horror, It's
that is the new French extremity nihilism stuff that you're just like, I need to take a shower and a vacation after you watch the movie.
That's why I don't stay at the bar after 2, that's kind of like, don't break.
Terry watch Fat Girl recently. So I've exposed him to a lot of, not that he doesn't already expose himself, but I've definitely forced you to watch some weirder shit, Terry. I almost made you watch 29 Palms actually recently. I was like, I don't know if I should make you watch that, but it's good.
Yeah, Kashi told me not to watch it. She was like, "This is too disturbing."
So yeah, for years.
Like a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen Fat Girl though.
Yeah, I
need to. Oh, that's a good one. Catherine Breillat.
Fucked up.
Very much not. It's horror, but in a very different kind of way about autonomy over the female body and how you feel about how fat women are treated versus skinny women. You would probably actually really enjoy it if you want to watch a pretty intense, emotionally intense film. Yeah. Fat Girl.
Let's go. Mm-hmm. Golly. Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, got off on the, because like 29 Palms, I've never heard anyone else talk about that movie before.
That's like what scarred me as an adult. It was 29 Palms.
Oh, yeah.
Cool.
Sorry. Tim, what about you? It was about things that's like, if like, what was the last thing to really scare you or like, to get under, like, this movie still get under your skin as an adult?
I mean, we got this Michael Haneke triple feature thing. I watched like Benny's Video and Code Unknown, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I watched those films. Have you seen either of those?
I've seen Benny's Video, and that movie made me, that was a movie that I felt kind of nauseous after watching. I was like, I need a break. I need to watch like a bunch of cat videos.
I know, seriously, that it is so dark, and there's kind of an observational, almost documentary realism to those films that just
makes
you feel like he's just filming real life. That is, and it just deals with darkness lurking beneath the surface. Like you feel like you can just meet this person walking on the street. So there's a very kind of approachable feeling to it, or it's like, oh yeah, this could be my next door neighbor. That just makes it deeply scary and hard to shake.
It is so funny because it's like the older you get, the more it's realism that scares you, you know? It's not what used to scare you as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, that's probably a really obvious statement, but just
no, but it's interesting, you know, like a lot of my friends and people I know that have kids that used to love horror now like aren't big horror heads anymore. And I'm like, that makes me so sad. But I understand like why that change, like some people that changes, but like it definitely does shift. And it's weird how it shifts as you get older and things that what bothers you that you didn't think would ever bother you versus it's very interesting to see how your brain changes.
And it's weird too, like working on projects like this, because I think the more gruesome, gory, gaggy stuff, like for us, is really exciting because you get fixated on how did they do that? And, you know, how did they achieve it? And, you know, we love practical effects. And so there's something that kind of strips away the magic and the suspension of disbelief once you start making stuff. But when it's rooted in realism, there's really no hiding anything. And it's very easy to submit to the reality of what's going on. Whereas so many horror films, we love just to kind of be like, whoa, how did they do that? Or we're so inspired by that. Looking at all the, you know, like the Giallo stuff and Fulci and all that. We're just like kids in a candy store about how they execute that stuff.
Yeah. But that was actually one of the things on set. It's so funny because it's like we had all this body horror going on and that never really affected us. But there's this scene where Nell screams and it's this just like blood curdling scream. And she did that on set and I started to like shake and our AD was like, what's going on? Are you okay? I'm like, no, I just don't want to do another take because I don't want to hear that again. You know, it's interesting how that the fear becomes more visceral, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, that seems like maybe a good point for us to talk about the film that you both picked. What film are we talking about today, Tim and Arkasha?
The Exorcist.
Very fitting that you picked The Exorcist. But I'd love to hear, is this both of your picks or is it more one than the other? Like, I'd love to hear your Scarred for Life story, starting with who it scared the most, maybe.
Well, it terrified me as a kid. But I became obsessed with it as a kid. Like there was like this love-hate relationship with it. And the older I get, the more I watch it and the more it scares me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's so, really like, oh, sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt.
No, I was just going to say, it's really a movie about motherhood, I think.
Yeah.
And the closer I get to motherhood, the more I'm like, oh, this is such a like spiritually, emotionally dangerous role, you know, to have in life. And I think, that is the new thing that's really terrifying me about this movie. But what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I have a distinct memory of watching it on like VHS on a small TV in my room in broad daylight. And the thing that's so crazy about this movie, I think, is like the psychological use of sound design and how, you know, Reagan doesn't walk into that room and pee on the floor until like 40 minutes into the movie. The word exorcism isn't mentioned until midway through the film. But up until that point, because of the use of sound, you're so unnerved and you're so on edge. And, you know, also this whole notion of not knowing what's wrong with you and kind of being poked and prodded by doctors. And again, like your body really not belonging to you. Like that's so terrifying in a way that I wasn't expecting as a kid. And there's that medical procedure where they're looking for the lesion that is still, that's one of the top five scariest things ever. And like, talk about it not changing from being a child to now. Like I still have to look away from the screen during that scene. So much of it, what's scary to me, doesn't actually have to do with the exorcism itself. It's what leads up to it. And it's a film that's not afraid to take its time to develop relationships or your relationship to the characters, which is so crucial that you fall in love with the characters before everything goes wrong. So,
it sounds like your relationship to the scares of the movie have changed since a kid. Do you remember, was it a specific scene that like hit you when you were a kid, or was it just the whole vibe of the film?
Oh God. Yeah. And this is probably really, you know, obvious, but I think the scene, the crucifixion scene.
Absolutely.
Know? Yeah. And I think, and what was so terrifying about that scene when Reagan's kind of stabbing herself with crucifix wasn't Linda Blair's, you know, a goddess. And she was amazing, but it was really the mother, you know, Ellen Bernstein's reaction that scared me as a kid. And I think it was because you realize, like throughout the whole movie, you see Reagan deteriorate, but what's really fascinating is seeing the mother deteriorate and the mother starting to lose hope and control and realizing that these people in your life who you think are completely infallible are actually quite fragile. And like you, and this is all like, I think I was maybe cognizant of some of this as a kid. I just remember feeling so deeply disturbed by Ellen Bernstein, like the way she cried, because you start to realize that so much of your life is put into place in order to not see the people you love feel or look vulnerable. Like that's the scariest thing in the world, is to see your child or your mother cry. And that just like, I was like, I swear I will never act this way, Mom. I will never.
I had a friend named Reagan who acted like Reagan when she was a kid. Isn't that terrible?
Oh, heck no.
I know. And there's always a joke with her family, but I was like, I've seen The Exorcist. Is this girl going to be crazy?
You never know.
Don't know how she's doing now. Hope she's doing great. Don't know what she's like now, but... Well, I love what you said about the medicalization of the female body, because I think that's what really freaks me out watching that movie now, because especially as a woman going to the doctor, and I've recently had some health issues, like there is so much even now where doctors don't believe women, especially if you are a woman of color, a Black woman, like anything to do with your body. Doctors are very quick to dismiss female pain and female like physical experiences. And I didn't think about that part of The Exorcist until like I was older and realizing that like this poor girl is just surrounded by men constantly literally poking and prodding her and like taking her bodily fluids and like basically like, violating her in so many different ways that, you know, is technically consensual, but kids can't give consent like adults can. And that this movie does a lot of that, but it does show like the pain that this child is going through because what the adults think. And I think that always scares me the most, especially when I was a kid. I was always so terrified of those movies where like, oh, the adults don't believe me, like I'm screwed. And like, that is so terrifying as a kid, was like not being believed and being taken seriously and being subjected to so much like medical experimenting when you're like, it's not medical. So that part is just continues to be so fucking scary to me, especially for a little girl who has no idea what the hell is going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, it's entirely without her permission. So it's It's so, so freaky. And do you know the story behind that scene, that the angiograph, I think is what they call it, the procedure that she receives?
I don't think so.
Terry, have we talked about, I don't know if we have, I don't think.
I'm not sure if we have or not.
I don't think we have.
What is his background, Friedkin, you know, came from the world of documentaries. So he went and saw this procedure, I think at New York University. And he was so impressed by how they handled it. He said, all of you guys can be in the film to basically reenact that procedure. And it's kind of barbaric. I think even at the time, you know, in the 70s, it was something that technological advancements had kind of taken people away from that. But, you know, you're putting a catheter into the artery to take x-rays of blood vessels that are in and around the brain. And it turns out that this guy, his name, I think, is Paul Bateson.
Yeah. Well, yeah, go ahead.
No,
go.
Yeah, ended up being convicted of murder. He is suspected of having killed six people and dismembered them.
And what?
He's the guy that is actually trying to reassure Reagan as he, you know, sticks a needle into her artery.
Yeah.
So there's this whole kind of subtext of violation, just even in that. You'll never watch the scene the same way again when you see this guy, knowing that he, and this is another crazy story, is that he was in prison. Friedkin apparently visited him in prison and drew inspiration, which is what convinced him to direct Cruising, apparently.
Well, so yeah, the way he got told about Cruising was he was handed the script and he said, this isn't really my world. And they said, you have to do this movie. You're spiritually bonded to this movie because you filmed this killer in The Exorcist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mind blown.
Hold on. The killer is... The Cruising killer is based on the guy.
Mm-hmm. And you'll see him. He has this like leather wristband in The Exorcist, I think. Yeah.
Yes, it's so wild. It takes like an already incredibly disturbing scene and just makes it all the more unsettling once you know that. And just like I said, to know that he got a front row seat to this procedure and said, like, great, come do that in my film, just kind of speaks to the visceral kind of realistic nature of the horror and kind of how he went about things. Yeah. And obviously there's all kinds of horror stories behind the scenes on that film. But, you know,
That is the only one I have not heard.
Yeah,
to be honest,
I had never
with
you. Heard that before.
Yeah, it's wild.
But you know what's so interesting is, and this is not to get all like new age on it, but so we worked with Sonia Braga, right? Who is incredible. And she said something our first day. She goes, I was like, so we're going to shoot the film. She goes, no, we're not making a film. And I said, what? And and she goes, no, you have invited us all to create a world and a reality. And we're going to live in that world and reality. And maybe a film will come out of it. But that film is just going to be like a trinket from that world. And it kind of blew my mind. And then thinking about what she said in relationship to The Exorcist, so much was invited into this reality. And there are so many stories about things coming out of that filming. And so much was pushed to the brink of reality that I'm so not surprised when I hear stories like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Wow, I'm going to have to once we're done, I'm going to be digging down rabbit holes to try to find information about this. That's nuts. Like that movie feels cursed in some ways, right? Where it's like there's all the stories, there's all the urban legends that came out of it. But some of the real life nuggets are even wilder than like this, than the sort of mythology that is developed over the film. It's wild. We did cover this film once before, and we John Leonetti, the Conjuring cinematographer, he saw this in the theater back when it first came out. So like getting to hear sort of like the first reactions of people seeing the film, and then seeing kind of like the mythology that is built about the movie in the decades since it's interesting. It's so wild to me that this little film has basically impacted all of the way that we talk about religious horror for decades since. It's wild.
Well, it's so I don't think a movie like that is ever going to be made again because of the way it was made. And I know that sounds obvious, but I think now there's so much pressure to remove the filming procedure from reality. Like everything's going to be effects or CG. And so people are reacting to things that aren't on set with them. And so there's, in my opinion, like there's a layer of authenticity that's kind of, you know, getting lost to the ether, whereas everything on that set was real. Like he had guns set out for him every day so that he could shoot off guns behind actors' heads to get them to react, you know, like Father Karras when
he's listening. We can't do that now for probably good reasons. That
absolutely one. Not do that. Yeah. But it's like that when Father Karras is listening to the recording of Reagan's voice backwards and the phone rings and he has that intense reaction, that's because Friedkin shot a gun right behind camera. You know, it's like things, the line between real reactions and performed reactions don't really exist in that movie, you know?
Yeah. Even the stuff. Ellen.
Oh, sorry.
Blair, you know, had spinal injuries resulting from all these stunt gear and that he would strike actors. And it is kind of like it's a cautionary tale in a way, because it's a director who's at the peak of his powers and abusing that power, you know? It's a really difficult because it's such an effective film. But then when you read the tactics that were used to achieve it, it definitely leaves a bad taste in your mouth for sure.
Yeah. Is it worth it?
Yeah.
Ooh. But this kind of, I think, leads towards the tail end of our talk about like religious horror. You brought The Exorcist, which terrified you, and you have yourselves made a religious horror film. Why do you think that this topic continues to feel so relevant regardless of the decade of the century?
I think because you're mining to the core of our personal definitions of good and evil and our relationship to that, both spiritually and physically. But what's interesting, I think, about religious horror is that really good religious horror has nothing to do with religion. It actually has to do with its interpretation of religion.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, well, you know, can I sidebar real quick with a story?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thanks. So before we were officially hired, neither Tim or I had been to Rome. So we're like, if we're going to take this seriously, we need to go and learn some history about Rome. And so we went and we were just kind of wandering around in the rain, not sure what to do. And then we came across this building with a giant sign on it that said Satan. And we were like, oh, we're here.
We're here.
This is perfect. And turns out that it was Dante Aguilera's 750th anniversary since his death. And there was like an art exhibit, like a multi-storied art exhibit to the topography of hell. And so we went in and there's all these beautiful tableaus of hell. Like there's Bosch tableaus and there's Rodin sculptures. And you just see like, it's all torture. It's all just like humans being tortured by animals with pitchforks and fire. And then the next floor is artwork that's created by a lot of Holocaust survivors and people that survived out of concentration camps. And it's one-to-one, the imagery. It's terrifying. It's and you start to realize, and that floor was called Hell on Earth, right? But you start to realize that, I don't know, hell is man-made and we conjure up hell, and religious horror is interesting because it's about using the devil as a tool, but the devil isn't actually the scary one. And so that was kind of our philosophy when making this film, is that the jackal and the devil, he's really a supporting character to the people who crave power to the point of being so corrupt that it almost pushes itself into a supernatural territory, this desire. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it really goes back to what we talked about initially. It's just like evil hiding in plain sight. I think to us, the more deviant, darker sides of human nature are oftentimes hiding behind a facade of, you know, good intentions. And I think that's what's scariest to us and really what we tried to kind of interrogate in this.
Yeah. But thank God in this movie, the spawn of the devil is marked, you know, that's so, how convenient.
Yeah.
It's very convenient. Like a little
yeah. Watch out for this guy, you know?
hey, can you just like show me all your hair really quick? Yeah. And I just like dig through your scalp like a monkey and see if I can find it in there first, just to make sure.
Yeah, and get your buzzers out. Yeah.
Oh man, well unfortunately we do have to wrap up soon, so but thank you both for joining us to talk about The Exorcist and The First Omen. I'm dying to see it. I cannot wait to see this movie. So where do you guys have a social media presence? Where can people find you? And the floor is yours to plug away with whatever you want to talk about.
We have no social media and we are hermits, so yeah.
I love it.
Thank you, though.
Well, everyone, see The First Omen when it comes to theaters. How about that?
Yes. And you know what? We made beautiful 35mm prints that will be playing at the Vista and the New Bev
in Los Angeles.
Yes.
Wow. That's so cool.
Yeah, we are very happy about it. So, check it out.
And we're hoping to kind of take them on a bit of a tour around the country. So be on the lookout, because we're going to try and get them to play as many places as possible.
Yeah.
It's going to be awesome. 35mm roadshow, which would be nice.
Let's go.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome.
Cool. Hell yeah.
That's awesome.
Cool. Well, listeners, you've heard from us. We want to hear from you. What are your experiences with The Exorcist? You can send us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us on social media. I'm at mbmcandrews on Twitter and at mb.mcandrews on Instagram.
And I'm at Gaily Dreadful everywhere.
And of course, you should already be following the podcast at Scarred Podcast on Instagram and Twitter and at, Blue Sky on Twitter and at Scarred for Life Podcast on Instagram. Apologies.
See, this is why you shouldn't have social media.
Much to remember.
Yeah, I know. And please don't forget to review, rate, and subscribe. And also, we were nominated for a Rondo. So if you were listening to this before the 16th of April, please go vote.
Thank you to Eric Power for our artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Please stay safe out there. But most importantly, stay creepy.
And until next time.